Hi everyone, I'm Chris Saldana, and this is the National Education Policy Center's Education Interview of the Month. I'd like to start by saying something about the murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis, Minnesota. I stand with Black Americans in this country who have endured over 400 years of violence and racism. You think that by now it would be obvious that racism and police brutality are unacceptable? Yet time after time, we see acts of violence against people of color, especially Black Americans. It's unacceptable and it has to end. I stand in solidarity with every individual who's protesting racial injustice and the inhumane treatment of individuals in any way or in any form. It has to stop. This month, we're speaking with Dr. Diane Ravitch. Dr. Ravitch is a research professor at New York University's Steinhardt School of Culture, Education, and Human Development, and the co-founder of the Network for Public Education. Dr. Ravitch is also the author of a new book entitled Slaying Goliath, The Passionate Resistance to Privatization and the Fight to Save America's Public Schools. Dr. Ravitch, thank you for being with us today.
Hi, Chris. Good to talk to you.
So, Diane, I'd like to start by asking you about what motivated you to write Slaying Goliath. And how would you say this book fits into your past research?
I actually hadn't expected to write this book. As you may know, I have been a very strong supporter of accountability testing, charter schools, et cetera, over a long period of time. So I had a long history with standards testing, accountability, and worked in several different conservative think tanks. And after the passage of No Child Left Behind, I initially didn't have any second thoughts, but by about 2006, I began to think this isn't working, and I began to review my basically everything I had been writing and saying for years, and thinking, you know, I think I'm wrong. I mean, I thought that charters were a great idea when the idea first came out because they hadn't been tried. And now that we have lots of examples of charters, they're not saving anybody. Many of them are closing because they're bad schools, and profiteers are getting into the charter racket. And I began to see the harm done by No Child Left Behind's singular emphasis on testing. And about that time, 2006, 2007, I began to disagree with myself, with my past positions. And I began to write a book that came out in 2010 called The Death and Life of the Great American School System, How Testing and Choice Are Undermining Education. And that represented a dramatic 180-degree turn in terms of where I stood in the education debates. Subsequently, and I guess it was when I was going around and talking about the book, a reporter was following me, and he said, your critics say that you have lots of criticisms, but where are your answers? So then I decided to write a second book, which is called Reign of Error, The Hoax of the Privatization Movement and Its Danger to America's Schools. And that book, about a third of it was an answer to his question. And the purpose of the book was to say, here's what we should be doing instead. And then I thought, well, I've done this. I have nothing more to say about any of this stuff. But I continue to be very active because I helped to create something called the Network for Public Education and became very involved in advocacy on behalf of public schools and began writing a blog in 2012, which kept me very engaged in issues around the country. And in the spring of 2018, I was absolutely riveted by the outbreak of teacher strikes starting in West Virginia. And as I followed the move west across the country, it occurred to me that there was another book that I had to write that would close out this set of three. And this was a book, a hopeful book. So when you ask, why did I write it? I was inspired by the teacher strikes. It occurred to me at that time, and since then, that what the teacher strikes did was to change the narrative, which had become so stale over the previous 10 or 20 years, which is that testing and accountability would cure all the problems, that charters and vouchers would save children from failing public schools, that public schools were awful, and that the public sector was terrible and needed to be saved by privatization and entrepreneurs and innovation and blah, blah, blah. And I thought, you know, when the teachers started striking, the national media began singing a very different song. They stopped talking about the failure of public schools, and they started talking about the fact that our society was not investing what it should in education, the teachers were woefully underpaid, the teaching profession had been under assault for years, and that our public schools were providing incredibly valuable services and that they should be strengthened, not weakened, by this constant assault on them.
That's a great segue into my next question. You spoke about how teachers, with the most recent teacher strikes, have completely shifted the narrative about public schools. So how would you say this moment fit in historically with the story of public school teachers? And what impact, if any, do you think these teacher strikes will have now that we're facing a looming budget crisis in K-12 public schools?
Well, it's, you know, it's a two-edged kind of situation. On one hand, we were moving in a trajectory as a result of the strikes. We were moving towards, in many states, towards increasing the funding for public schools. All of the Democratic candidates for president were talking about tripling the Title I funding, increasing the funding for special education, dramatically increasing the amount of federal money that would come towards supporting schools. Things seemed to be going in that direction, and then the virus changed everything, closed down schools across the country. And I think that the result of the pandemic, and I've given a lot of thought to this, is first of all, it reminds people how important schools are. And it reminds us that what Betsy DeVos has been preaching for the last 3.5 years is so wrong. Because she's talked about how everybody basically is on their own, and that when she spoke to Alec in 2017, she quoted Margaret Thatcher saying there's no such thing as society. It's just individuals and families, and basically everyone paddles their own canoe. And in this moment of incredible national and international crisis, we all know that we have to do this together. There's no such thing as paddling your own canoe. We have to realize where we have to help one another. We have to help the most vulnerable. We have to stand together with those who are weakest. We have to make sure that kids who are fed, that they have their health care needs are taken care of. I mean, there is a sense of, in any crisis, whether it's a war or in this case a pandemic, where people realize that social solidarity is what's needed. And that means you have to have a functioning public sector. I think that, unfortunately, under the current federal administration, there has been a determined effort to pretend that the federal government doesn't need to do anything other than preach to us. So I think that there is a newfound appreciation of the importance of public schools because they're doing so much in their communities. And when I see the pictures and the videos of the teacher parades, it makes me almost want to cry because the teachers get in their cars and they drive around the neighborhood where their kids are, and the kids wave to them, and the teachers are waving and tooting their horns. And it's really a demonstration of how much the teachers love the children and the children love their teachers. And I've talked to many parents and teachers, and I'd say that the one thing that I hope will come out of this terrible period, and who knows how long it will last, is a renewed appreciation for the importance of having a live teacher in a real building. I mean, I know that DeVos likes to say that buildings don't educate children, which is total nonsense. Of course, buildings don't educate children, but education is best performed person to person and not via online communication.
So let me ask you about that, about online education and distance learning. So there's a number of educational policies that align with the privatization agenda. Some of these you talk about in Slaying Goliath, and others you've covered more recently in your blog. But there are three that I'd like to ask you about: online education, school choice, and then standardized testing. So let me start with online education. So do you think any caution should be given to how this crisis opens policy opportunities for advocates of online learning and technology in schools?
The crisis certainly opens opportunities. And the thing that's, I think, new and different about the last 20 years in American education is there is an education industry. There's always been an education industry, but it's pretty much stayed in the background. It's selling tests and selling hardware and software and school supplies. And it was not a big deal. I mean, you didn't have these salesmen pounding at your door all the time. I think the ed tech industry is so huge and so powerful and has so much money that they're also very much funded by Wall Street and their investors. And they are more omnipresent than ever, and they're looking for every opportunity to expand their market. And they would like to see, and I'm speaking now about the edtech industry, they would like to see more distance learning, more online education, and wean the schools away from face-to-face teaching. They call it personalized learning. And as you know from reading my book, I call it depersonalized learning, because personalized learning means that at least two and possibly more people have face-to-face contact. And that only happens where they're in the same space. So I think that the popular sentiment is kids should be in school because parents work. The idea that distance learning is somehow going to replace school buildings is ridiculous, because that assumes that somebody, the mother or the father, are going to be staying home all the time. And given the stresses on family finances, that's highly unlikely. So I see that there might be, there will certainly be more hardware and more software, but I think that the need for it will be, teachers will have to figure out when it's useful and when it's not useful, but it should be their decision. And I would hate to see any states adopting policies where they impose more distance learning and more use of technology, because the technology that's used should be in the hands of the teacher and serve the needs of the teachers and not the needs of the education industry.
So I also want to ask you about school choice, because it already was a complex issue. And now, like everything else, it's become even more complex. So one thing we've noticed with crisis, for example, in places like New Orleans or Detroit or Oakland, is that, again, it opens opportunities for a quote unquote innovative agenda or a way to reimagine education. So how do you see the coronavirus pandemic shaping the rhetoric about school choice right now?
Well, you know, I think that the choice people, with the exception of Betsy DeVos, have been more or less quiet during this period, because their kids have the same needs as the kids who are in public schools. And I think that everyone's first concern right now, no matter where they are on the ideological spectrum, is the health and well-being of children. But I think that when this is all over, as it will someday be, that we will once again have people like Betsy DeVos and Alec and all of the panoply of people advocating for privatization. They'll be back. And the reason they'll be back is because there's so much money there. But I think that at some point, and I'm thinking, for example, now of Texas, the charter expansion there is going by leaps and bounds, even though the charters are way underperform the public schools, and the state underfunds its public schools tremendously. So I believe that there is a turning of the tide, in that tide was running strongly against charters and vouchers before the pandemic. And I think they're going to have a hard time getting the momentum on their side, because I don't think there's anything about the pandemic that says we don't need public schools anymore. We should have lots of disconnected schools. If anything, at a time of social crisis as we are in now, we need a system that can meet the needs of all the kids, and not one where the strongest swimmers are the winners, and you know, we have winners and losers. The whole, let's say, goal of American education until the past 20 years was equality of educational opportunity. And school choice doesn't fit into that goal at all, because by the nature of school choice, and this is true, I think, internationally as well as here, it sorts kids into winners and losers. We know from lots of research that charters do about the same in terms of test scores. They come out at about the same as public schools if they have the same demographics. Those that have extraordinary test scores usually are skimming the kids they want and kicking out the kids they don't want. And that's not a model for public education. So we will go back to confronting the question, which many states have had to deal with. Can we afford to support two separate school systems? One, a charter system that has not only public funding, but lots and lots of private funding, and an underfunded public system where the charters push out the kids they don't want and send them to public schools. I think it's fundamentally an irrational direction to go. And my sense is that after 30 years of charters, we now know that they don't have some secret sauce. They're not more innovative than public schools, and that it is not a source of innovation to say, let's continue to do the same thing we've done for 30 years and expect to get different results. If we want to have great public schools, we have to invest in them. And given the pandemic, we're going to be fighting in every state in this country to just retain the funding that we had before the pandemic. And that'll be a battle. But the people who advocate for choice will continue to advocate for it, despite the fact that we have pretty solid research showing that vouchers are harmful, that kids lose ground. We'll have Betsy DeVos and her friends at ALEC advocating for virtual charter schools, despite the fact that even Credo says that they're abysmal. And we'll have, you know, the charter people will continue to fund because they have so much money. They will not look at the fact that what they've done has produced meager or no results. And they will not look at the fact that charter schools open and close with some frequency, whereas public schools, that they complain that public schools don't close, but that's one of their virtues, is that there is a stability to public schools. Public schools don't close in January and say you have to go find your own school. Charters have no secret sauce, and they just divert money from public schools. So I think that in the long run, we'll be faced with a situation where these people with vast resources continue to expend it to promote choice, but they have nothing to show for it. And at some point, they might even have someone say, you know, maybe we should be putting our money into something different. And that's another reason I wrote Slaying Goliath, which was to say to the people fighting privatization, there's hope, but also to send a message to like Bill Gates, Eli Broad, the Walton family, you are throwing your money down the drain. Find a different way to help kids. If you really want to help kids, this is not the way to help them. Choice doesn't do it, and find something different. The encouraging thing that I've seen was an article before the pandemic that appeared in EdWeek saying that a number of philanthropists, not including the big three of Gates, Broad, and Walton, but a number of philanthropists were deciding not to put their money anymore into what's called K-12 reform of standards, testing, and charters, but rather to look at areas like education and mental health, education in the arts, education and the school-to-prison pipeline. And I thought, yes, of course. Why not solve real problems instead of continuing to pour money into testing? And you know, we've had years and years of this testing with so little to show for it, and to continue to try to privatize entire districts. So New Orleans is the only district that's completely privatized, and I don't think anyone other than the people who are on the payroll down there think that it's a miracle.
So I do want to move to discussing the topic of philanthropy and education since you brought it up. For listeners who may not know, how would you describe a disruptor? And given the current and future financial hardships that many communities are facing and will face, how should communities that are hurting financially engage with philanthropy?
Well, in the first of the three books that I've written on this subject, which was in 2010, I had a chapter 10 called The Billionaire Boys Club. And one of the people in this movement, that they call themselves reformers. And I have a lot of trouble calling them reformers because they actually don't reform anything. Their goal is not to reform schooling, but to replace it with privately managed charters or religious schools on the extremes. So I was looking for another word to use other than reformers because, as I said, they reform nothing. Reformers want to make public schools better. They want them to get better funding or have better trained teachers or better this or better that, but they don't say, let's replace public schools with private management. So in looking for a word to describe this movement, I hit upon the idea of disruption because they proudly say we're disrupting education. They don't deny that they're disruptors. They think that it's a good thing. And this is business terminology. And I've heard businessmen say, we have to reinvent our industry every 2 years or we're in trouble. And there is this idea, I think it was associated with Clayton Christensen, who was at Harvard University in the business school, who spoke about the need to disrupt schooling. I think he has a book called Disrupting Schooling. And so they're proud of disruption. And the problem I have with this as a parent and now a grandparent is I don't want somebody else to disrupt my grandchildren's lives. If their parents choose to do it, I think that would be very foolish. The parents don't like disruption. Children don't like disruption. People generally want to protect children from disruption. And yet these philanthropists go into the disruption aspect of disrupting children's lives, teachers' lives, the lives of communities, and they think that they're doing good. Well, they're not doing good. They're simply creating chaos. And to me, it's, as I watch them in different districts, I think this is like a game of 52 pickup that was played way many years ago, where you just took a deck of cards, threw them in the air, and then you picked up 52 cards. They don't really know what the end result will be, except by now they do know, which is there will be a lot of demoralized teachers. They'll bring in a lot of Teach for America. They'll hire people from the Relay Graduate School of Education, which is not a graduate school of education, but just a training program for charter teachers. And they'll have a lot of, they'll have a bunch of people making, at the top, making a lot of money. So how should parents and districts act towards philanthropy? I think with, they should be very careful about letting the philanthropists come in with the philanthropist agenda. And communities and districts need to have their own agenda and say, we need your help, but we don't want you to control us. We want you to help us do what we want, which is to reduce class size. We want to have arts in our schools. We need your help to return the arts to our schools. We need your help to pay for a chorus, musical instruments, a marching band. These are things that kids really need. We need your help to create a robotics program. I mean, anybody who's a superintendent or a principal could come up with a laundry list. It should be the educators who are setting the agenda for what the needs of their schools are, because they know them best. But what has happened with the venture philanthropist is, and this is, was a real change, you can't, if you're a district, you can't go to the Gates or Broad or Walton Foundation and say, these are my needs, will you fund them? Because they won't fund them. They will say to you, we want charters, we want Teach for America, we want you to evaluate teachers by their test scores. And so they have their agenda, and if you're willing to go along with their agenda, they'll give you a lot of money. But their agenda has already failed, and I wanted to make that plain in Slaying Goliath. Since their agenda has failed, wouldn't it be refreshing if they were to actually fund the needs of schools as defined by the schools? And that would be a whole new thing for them. And I want to just say something about the status quo. When people talk about we need innovation in education, they have been saying this now for 25 years, but we have a new status quo. And the status quo is defined by the federal government, by the state governments following federal mandates, and by the education profession basically saying, well, I have to do it because of this law called No Child Left Behind, or the Race to the Top program, or now the Every Student Succeeds Act. This is federal law. We have to give these tests even though we know they're useless, and we have to spend the last 2 months of the year or the last couple of months preparing for the test, taking the test, and then May and June are pretty much wasted because the tests are over. But this is the status quo. And so when these folks say they want to disrupt and they want to change everything and they want to innovate, they are the status quo. They're not innovators. They're simply reinforcing what we've been doing for 20 or 25 years.
So you mentioned that Slaying Goliath is also a story about hope and about what teachers have shown that is possible in shifting the narratives about public education. So I want to ask you, what do you see as the role of students, families, communities, teachers, and administrators going forward? And what other recommendations would you have for policymakers?
I think that the biggest change that needs to happen is the change in, first of all, at the federal level. Trump and DeVos have been a total disaster for public education. They've provided negative influence. DeVos is the first Secretary of Education or Commissioner of Education in the history of the United States who is actually opposed to public education. I mean, I'm going all the way back to the beginning of the Office of Education in the 1860s. I think it was 1867. And its purpose was to collect data and do research. And then eventually it became, in the last year of Jimmy Carter's presidency, the U.S. Department of Education. But even in Republican administrations, there was none who said public education is a waste of time, it's a failed enterprise. And so changing at the top would be a first step. And so I think it's time really for innovative thinking. And really innovative thinking would be to change federal law. And that's where the change should begin. So what we need is to revert to the principles of the Elementary and Secondary Education Act of 1965. And its primary premise was equity. And that meant that more money would flow to the schools and the children that had the highest needs, that there would be adequate funding for their schools as there is for schools in advantaged communities. And there would be support for improving teacher education. And these were the pillars. Equity was the pillar of the original 1965 Act. And I think that that's what we need to restore today in order to free the schools from the excessive burden of standardized testing, which so that being the case, and I think it is true, I would like to see schools free to be creative, to be innovative, the teachers told that they will make the judgments about whether their kids are succeeding, that the testing will, and assessment of children will be in their hands, and that the accountability will be not at the bottom where the kids are, but at the top where the legislators and the policymakers are. They should be accountable for funding our schools. They should be accountable for making sure that no child is left in an overstuffed classroom and an under-resourced school and an underfunded district. That's their responsibility. And so you can't hold teachers accountable for conditions beyond their control, but they should be the ones who make the judgments about students' progress. And if I believe we should maintain the NAEP, and if we want to know how's the state doing, how's it doing compared to 2 years ago, 10 years ago, NAEP will tell us that. If we want to know what's happening with the achievement gaps, NAEP will tell us that. We don't need to spend billions of dollars on tests to find that out. So I think if you say, well, what can parents do? I think that parents, teachers, families, what they have to understand is what's most important. And what's most important is that children are healthy, that they're safe, that they have time to play, that they have the opportunity at school to try out different things, that they're not being punished by schooling, but rather encouraged to explore different interests, and that the school has the resources it needs for the children that it enrolls, and that it has a full program and a full curriculum, a time for play, time for recess, the arts, but also that it has the science labs that it needs, that it has the technology it needs. This is all, and if you lived in an affluent district, all of that would be in place. And so why do we even have to debate whether we should be funding it for the kids whose families can't afford those opportunities? And we simply reinforce the inequities by not providing them schools where they have class sizes that are 20 to 24. And well-prepared, experienced teachers, and the opportunity to be involved in the arts or robotics or video production, all these things that kids in well-to-do suburbs take for granted. So that would be my advice, is that parents need to advocate for their children, their school, their district. They need to be aware, and I think the most important thing is to be educated. To educate yourself about the forces that are trying to take away your democratic right to select your school leadership, as well as your democratic right to throw out the school leadership when they're not doing the right thing by the students. So I believe in elected local school boards because it offers the opportunity for change. And one of the negative things about charters and vouchers is it really does take away from parents the opportunity to choose who will be in charge of their schools.
Thank you, Dr. Ravitch, for being on the show this month. Again, Dr. Ravitch's book is entitled Slaying Goliath, The Passionate Resistance to Privatization and the Fight to Save America's Public Schools. As always, thank you for listening. We hope that you're safe. We hope that you're healthy. And again, for the latest analysis on public education, you should subscribe to the NEPC newsletter at nepc.colorado.edu and follow NEPC on Twitter at NEPCTweets.